Don't try this at home. I'm a trained professional. I got years and years of practice living this life I lead. Don't try this at home. I'm a trained professional. And I don't want no amateurs ending up like me. I don't want no amateurs ending up like me.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Homeowner's Friend Podcast. I'm Steve, your host, and on today's show, we're going to take a look at the storm damage from Hurricane Eileen or Irene, whatever it was, I can never remember. And also, we'll take a look at a question that came in on patios. They basically wanted to know the best way to put one in, what I thought of them, that kind of stuff. So we'll talk about that second. First, though, Eileen. In Connecticut, Eileen was an interesting storm. It hit the shore basically as, I think it was more of a tropical storm than a hurricane, but it might have been barely a hurricane. It was right on the edge. And really, as far as storms go, it wasn't, you know, I don't think it was that bad. In fact, where I live, we didn't even get hardly any wind. We got a lot of rain, however. We got almost a foot of rain where I live, and a lot of the rivers peaked, and there was some flooding, you know, stuff that normally floods. There was a few towns, like Bristol, that got really nailed with the flooding, and the water was running down Main Street and washed out some buildings and ruined some roads and stuff, but, you know, was relatively localized, not what I would consider a really large event, you know, for the state. However, over in the eastern part of the state, they got just enough wind to knock down a bunch of trees, and the power was out for virtually the entire eastern half of the state for days. There was a Northeast Utilities is our utility company here, and they had a map on the web, and I actually should have taken a PDF copy of it because it was pretty interesting. It showed the whole left of the side of the state. It was all color. It's a color-coded map by town, and black meant 0% of the people had power, and then there was like, you know, dark purple was like 10%, and you know, red was 20% or so. I don't know what the numbers were, but the whole left side of the state, pretty much from the Connecticut River over, with a few exceptions here and there, were entirely black, which meant nobody over there had power. And it took quite a while for them to restore. The storm hit on Saturday evening, and power didn't come back to many people over on that side of the state till Wednesday or Thursday. And in a lot of cases, a lot of people didn't get back till the weekend. So they were out of power for the better part of an entire week. And people were pretty ticked off. The power company wasn't doing communications very well. Now they're on the radio doing a bunch of advertisements trying to... The CEO Butler there is on the radio trying to, you know, say how we know we had some communications problems, but we thank you for being patient, et cetera, et cetera. You know, whatever. I guess I can't blame them. I mean, it was a big, big storm, but I think that they really tried. You know, it seemed to me, and I'm just a bystander, but it seemed to me they were trying to micromanage the whole situation too much. They needed to just let the crews that come in just do the work. You know, but they wanted to manage everything, so. Crews came in from out of state, and then they sat in parking lots for a day or two before they got assignments, which I think is kind of dumb. But nonetheless, once the crews got in and they got going, they did get the power back pretty quickly. But it was quite a shock to a lot of people. A lot of people bought generators that week and have vowed to buy them afterwards. But what I wanted to get into, which I think is even more interesting than the storm, is the result of the storm as far as the retail situation here in Connecticut. I went to the local Stop and Shop, which is a, you know, regional grocery store here. I think actually it was like Wednesday or Thursday before the storm, several days, just to do some shopping. And my wife said that I better pick up, a bottle of water just to have for the baby, you know, for bottles and stuff, bottled water, in case something happens to the water. I have water stored at home anyway, and it's fine. It's, you know, I rotate it and stuff, but, you know, whatever. So I bought a couple gallons of water. When I was in the store, I walked down to the water aisle, and there wasn't one container of water to be found on the store shelves. The entire shelf was empty of water. All that was left was some, like, carbonated water or something like that. There wasn't any plain water at all. Luckily, on the header, One of the stock boys had brought out a couple of miscellaneous cases of store brand water, and I was able to grab one or two of those. But pretty much the entire store was out of water. And there was other things in the store that were out as well, or nearly out. Bread had taken quite a hit. Some of the dairy products. It was really pretty amazing. You could not buy, see, the governor got on the radio like Tuesday or Wednesday and said, you know, you need to go out, you need to buy some supplies, you need to buy batteries, flashlights, things like that, gas up your cars. And people listened to him, amazingly. You could not buy a C or D cell flashlight or battery in the state of Connecticut. I swear they were all gone. I was in quite a few stores, not looking to buy any because I've got about 50 home already, but literally, I got like 50 deep batteries home. I buy the bricks at Costco just for such an emergency, so I don't have to worry about it. But there was none available. I was in the drugstore picking a prescription, and I just for ha-has went over and looked. They had nothing. Of course, the Stop and Shop had nothing. The local hardware store had nothing. Even the gas stations that charge like $8 a battery, they were picked clean as well. Pretty interesting. But the really interesting thing, which I think was really the most damaging for folks, was that you couldn't even get gas. Before the storm, the gas stations were running out of gas. And, you know, I've talked about this before, the whole just-in-time system, where everything today is designed for regular deliveries to be able to have enough supply of whatever it is that they're selling on hand to keep the supply flowing, you know, so people can buy it during normal times until their next shipment. And their next shipment comes in pretty quick, so they don't store a lot of anything. Nobody does, really, these days. And gas stations are no exceptions. The tanks in the ground are big enough to supply, the average load for that station in between fill-ups. And, you know, certainly a little bit more, I'm sure. I'm sure they overestimate. But people were going, but what was happening is like on Wednesday and Thursday, of course, the storm was coming Saturday. Now, Wednesday and Thursday, people were going shopping that would normally go, you know, get gas and supplies on Wednesday and Thursday. But also the people that would go on Friday or even Saturday, even Friday or Saturday and Sunday were also going because the storm was coming and they didn't want to try and go out during the storm. So everybody was trying to fill up their gas tank on Wednesday and Thursday, and by golly, a lot of the gas stations ran out of gas. And I've got some pictures. I'll try and throw some of this stuff up on the blog. I think it's pretty fascinating. So there was actually gas shortages even before the storm hit, and certainly shortages of other supplies. Now once the storm hit, afterwards, of course, the power went out. Now, up where I live, the power went out for a couple hours. It was no big deal. But still, the stores were out of everything and there was no gas. Over in eastern Connecticut, which is, I was over there for some reasons later in the week. And over in eastern Connecticut, of course, they had no power. And I was in one town over there, and there was one gas station in town open. Now, this is a fairly good-sized town, not a city by any stretch of the imagination. It's Plainfield. It was probably like, just probably, I don't know, 20,000 people in Plainfield or something like that. And there was one gas station open. And it was only one gas station open because it was the only one in town that had power. There was one little strip of Main Street there that had power. The rest of the town was out. It was one of the mainly black towns. And this gas station, I didn't take a picture of it. I wish I did. But this gas station had a line literally about a quarter of a mile long going down the road trying to get into this gas station. This little mom and pop, you know, two or three pump gas station. Amazing. And I guarantee that gas station ran out of gas shortly after I went by. These gas stations only carry 3,000 or 4,000, 5,000 gallons of product. And when you have, you know, people coming and buying 30, 40, 50 gallons at a clip, you know, 100 customers later, they're out. And with the line down the road, I guarantee that station was out of product within a few hours. Just amazing. And even after the power came back on again, driving around, a lot of the gas stations were totally out of fuel. There was none to be had. And again, you still couldn't buy any of the other staples as well. A lot of the convenience stores were closed. Most of the grocery stores were closed because there was no power. Even the bigger ones in the bigger towns were closed. The grocery stores were at this point throwing out all their produce and all their meats because it all went bad, costing, I'm sure, some insurance companies probably tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah, I mean, they were literally filling up big roll-off dumpsters with food. That's got to be a lot of money. And you would think it would be cheaper to buy a generator, but I guess I'm wrong. I don't know. But it just doesn't seem seem, you know, even if you don't buy one to run the whole store, just buy one to run one cooler and one freezer so they could put everything in it. I don't know. I guess it doesn't make sense, but whatever. They threw out all that food, but all those stores were closed, so people couldn't even get food or water. Everything was shut down. And the town halls came, you know, a lot of them had power and stuff and generators, and they came on and started, you know, supplying water. And then by Wednesday or Thursday, the state started distributing through FEMA some water and MRE food and stuff like that. So people were starting to get some supplies there. And of course, you know, where there was power, they were giving out water and stuff for, you know, flushing toilets and whatever. So things started to come back online at that point, but it was a pretty interesting few days, and I learned a lot. I can't say that I learned a lot, because I knew this stuff was going to happen, and if you listen to my old shows on preparation, I told you it would happen. But I guess I learned a lot in that, you know, it really does happen this way, and more importantly, I learned a lot about the reaction of the people. The people were very, very frustrated, very upset, and in some cases, downright PO'd about the situation. And, you know, I just can't help but think that, you know, if you live in a rural area, like relatively rural area like that, or any area for that matter, that you should have at least some level of preparations. And most of these people have had none. And, you know, a day or two after the storm, they were all belly aching, and it was because they just had no preparations at all. These same people, a lot of them have very nice vehicles, very nice homes. You know, they have, you know, big screen TVs, the high speed computers, the whole bit. It's not like they're poor. They just didn't put any effort at all into preparing for emergencies. So that's why I keep, you know, telling you folks to do this. It's important. Because the bottom line is, folks, this storm was a wimp. This storm was nothing. Like I say, it hit the coast. I think it hit the coast from the, you know, they don't really know, but it seems like it hit the coast at a tropical storm level. It wasn't even a full-fledged hurricane. And even if it was a hurricane, it would have been a Category 1. If this was a Category 2 or a Category 3 storm, we probably would never hit a 4 or 5 here. It just doesn't happen up here in New England. They kind of peter out as they come up the coast. But if it was a solid 1 or a 2, the power outages would have been probably tenfold of what had happened in this storm, and we'd probably still be out of power in spots, and people would really, really be hurting if that had happened. So considering this was a very wimpy storm, a lot of bad things still happened. Oh, and on the power outages, what kind of happened? I don't know, you know, a lot of you haven't experienced this, but Connecticut's a very, very heavily treed state. Lots of trees, big trees, and, you know, they're on the side of the roads all over the place. And in most areas, the power is also, you know, on telephone poles above ground as well. And of course, the trees just fall on the lines, and they break the lines. But occasionally, they also break the poles, or certainly quite often, they break the cross supports, you know, the wooden pieces on the top of the poles. They'll snap those things and all this stuff. You know, so the power company has to come in and first of all, make sure that the power is off. They have to ground all the lines and make sure everything's safe. Then they go in and have to cut the tree off the lines and, you know, untangle the whole mess, and then they have to start rebuilding that area of service. You know, to put the poles back up, or you know, put the lines back up, put the cross pieces, whatever it takes to rebuild it. It takes time. You know, you can't do it in 5 minutes. It could take a half a day or a day to fix one. You know, the problems caused by one stupid tree. You know, one crew. So it's not something that happens immediately. So, you know, considering there was literally trees down on every road in pretty much every town, that's why it just took so long to restore. Just, you know, but again, if it was a Category 2 or 3, I bet you there would have been 2 or 3, 5 times more trees down than there were. And again, it would have been a whole lot worse. So I guess it's just a wake-up call for folks, and of course most folks won't wake up, but it is a wake-up call that you really need to at least have some level of preparations in your home for these kinds of events. Again, have some water, have some kind of food that you can eat without much preparation. It's not going to go bad when the power goes out. The power will go out. You know, have things like flashlights and batteries, and have some way of cooking food. And if you can swing it and afford it, you know, get yourself a generator. People are spoiled. We like our electricity. We like having electric lights and having, you know, our stoves work and our furnaces and air conditioners or whatever. And having a generator will allow that to happen. But as I've always said, a generator is useless without gas. And you can see that in this kind of an event, and it happened here in Connecticut, and I have pictures to prove it, you might not be able to get gas. So make sure you have ample gas at your home. You know, you should have at least 30 or 40 gallons of gas stored up at your house in some place that's safe. Naturally, not in your house or in your garage, but maybe in a shed somewhere, or you can make some kind of a special, like a doghouse type of thing or something, but some place to keep, you know, at least 20 gallons of gas. Something to run that generator. You know, you should be able to run the generator as much as you need it for at least 3 or 4 days, and it'd be better to have enough to run it for a whole week. So depending on the size of the generator and how much fuel it sucks, that's what you should have just for this kind of emergency. And you should have that gas all the time, because sometimes, a lot of times emergencies happen and you don't know they're going to happen. In this case, we had, you know, like a week's ahead of time, you know, a week's notice that this thing was coming, and everybody got ready. But it's possible that a storm like this could hit without any warning at all. Of course, it wouldn't be a hurricane, but it could be tornadoes, it could be, you know, ice storm, it could be any number of things where there really is no warning, or not much of a warning. So just heed my advice, folks, and it'll make your life a whole lot easier. So, question two. I got a question in on email about patio. Somebody's looking to put in a patio. It just kind of wanted my... They asked me a couple of specific questions, which I answered. Not really anything I need to talk about on the air specifically, but they asked me just basically my opinion on them. You know, like stamped stone or you know, the pavers-type patios. And I really like them. And, in fact, I'm probably thinking of putting one in at my house as well if I can get my... get some spare minutes. I've been very busy this summer, so I haven't done too many of these shows. But it's a lot of work to put one in, because you've got to, you know, the most important thing in putting in one of these patios is to have a good base, because the stones are just sitting on earth usually. That, you know, you put them on crushed stone or on sand or something, and that's what supports the stones. And of course, if you have water collecting under there or something, in the winter it can freeze and lift the stones up. Or it can also wash out the stone, or it could sink. You know, the underlying soils can sink or wash away, making your stone drop or fall in, or you know, whatever the case may be. So it's very important to have a good base underneath the pavers, and you need to have good drainage. And if it's a really, really wet area where you want to put one, you really need to do something to try and dry that area out. Again, you know, a lot of stone, a lot of sand, good draining material or something down there. First of all, so it's not popping up. The pavers themselves are really good. They're pretty rugged. You know, I guess you could break one, but you'd probably have to drop, you know, a hammer on it or something. They're pretty tough. Not too hard to work with, really. They're pretty straightforward. You have to have something to cut them if you want to be able to cut. You know, if you're going to have any kind of fancy designs and you need some cut stones, you can use a tile saw type of saw. They have them that are specifically made for these kinds of stones. You can use a regular skill saw with a masonry blade on it. You can somehow hold the stones, you know, some like a little vise or something. You can hold the stones and cut them with the saw. Very, very dusty. Probably going to ruin your saw, so if you have an old crappy saw, use that. You know, you certainly don't need to be that accurate when you do this. You know, there's wet saws that are made to cut these as well. There's different products, and you can also try and score them and do it with a chisel and a hammer. You know, score it all the way around and gently tap it, and you can probably break them that way too. But it's probably more trouble than it's worth. Probably easier to cut them. And I'm sure if you go to any rental place, you can rent a wet saw that will cut them very easily, cut them like butter. So that's probably what I'm going to do when I get ready to do it, if I think I'm going to need to cut any. I'm going to do pretty much a plain, straight, square patio, so I don't think I'll even have to cut any. I'll just go full blocks by full blocks and let it stop where it stops. You know, I'm not going to worry about it too much. But the patio blocks are really good. There's a lot of different designs. You know, just don't go to one store and look. Go to some different stores. In most areas, you'll find masonry supply houses that stock whole lines of these things. And they go really from very basic, you know, they look like brick, all the way up to very fancy stones. They almost look like cobblestones, or, you know, they're different shapes, interlinking. Some of the stones are actually you know, they might be like square on one side and octagonal on the other, and they all lock together, and it makes a very interesting look, you know, when it's done. It doesn't look like plain old pavers or plain old, you know, bricks or something. It looks like a very fancy stone, you know, walkway. So, you know, there's a lot of different styles, but some of these are very expensive too. I had a neighbor that put in a patio. It wasn't all that big. I don't know, but it was maybe 15 by 15, something like that. And it cost him like a couple grand just for the pavers and the little bit of stone dust that he had brought in. So it can cost a lot of money if you get the more fancy stones. I'll probably just go with a plain brick type looking stone, something fairly straightforward, you know, rectangular type stone. Those are cheaper. And you get those kind of stones at, you know, Home Depot, Lowe's. Most of your smaller home centers have them, and a lot of lumber yards have them too. And it's worth really, you know, getting to know your local lumber yard. A lot of times you can especially if you do a bit of work, you can talk with them and you can actually set an account up with them. You may be able to get somewhat of a cash discount as well if you want to go that way. And it works nice, you know, to have that local relationship. I have an account with one of the local lumber yards here that I used when I built my house, and they give me, I think, it's something like 10% off the price of everything in the store for being an account member. And then if I pay, or it's 5% off, 10% or something like that, and if I pay cash for the bill, you know, within 10 days of receiving it or something like that, I get another couple percent off. So it adds up, and especially since their prices are cheaper than Home Depot's prices to begin with anyway. It does add up, but I gave them a bit of business when I built the house. Haven't dealt with them really in a couple of years. I don't even know if my account's still valid, but I might go to them and see what they have for these pavers as well, because I figure I'll get a better deal than at most other places. So once you get the pavers, of course, and you put the base in, and you know, they always give you good instructions. Make sure you follow them. You'll lay the pavers in. You want to make sure that the base is well tamped down with a tamper or with a vibrating compactor or something like that before you put the stones in. And then once you put the stones down, you usually want to run over the stones themselves with that same compactor to make sure they set good in that sand underneath. They want them to kind of sink in a hair, so they're nice and flat and well, you know, tucked into that underlayment, so to speak, so they're not wobbly or anything like that. And then usually you sweep in a fine sand or something between them to just to fill the voids between the blocks. That also helps keep them from rocking. And that's it. I mean, it's pretty simple. Anybody can do it. It's just a bit of work. These blocks, you know, they get heavy after a while. You have, you know, they weigh a bit. You know, if you move one or two, it's not a big deal. But if you try and move more than that, they might be heavy. It's like those, you know, pre-made wall stone. You know, they get to be heavy after a while. They get heavier as the project goes on. They all weigh the same, but boy, I'll tell you, they do get heavier. I'll testify to that when I was doing that wall in Vermont. By the end, my back was pretty sore. But they do a nice job. They're really nice and they're easy to work with. So I recommend doing it if you want to go that route. You know, just understand it's a bit of work, and not a free project either. You're going to spend a little bit of money to do it, but it's awfully nice. And if you do it right and really take your time and put a good base in and put the stones in good and make everything good and tight, you really won't have to do anything with that patio for years and years and years. And they last a long time, barring some, you know, major catastrophe. Funny story, one of our neighbors, our old neighbors, had a tree that fell down. They had a patio. It was a nice, well-installed patio. And the tree fell down, and one of the branches, this is a big tree. It was one of these big V-shaped trees, and you know, one of the sides was probably, the wood was probably a good, I don't know, it was probably pretty close to 3 feet across. I mean, it was a big tree, two and a half feet anyway, across. And this thing came down, and one of the branches had a pretty big branch on it. The branch hit the patio, and the weight of the tree actually jammed that branch right into the ground. It actually pushed one of the concrete block about 6 inches into the soil, believe it or not. And that branch got pushed into the soil. This is after going through the patio. Actually pushed the soil, that branch, it pushed that branch down into the soil a good 2.5 feet. And the guy, it took the guy a half a day just to get the branch out of the ground. It was so jammed in there. Just amazing, the force from those trees. So if you got trees near your house, folks, I recommend getting them the hell out of there, because especially old ones that are liable to fall, because if that thing fell on your house, actually this did fall on this guy's house, and it broke a few of the rafters in his garage and did a little bit of damage to his sunroom as well. I think it broke a couple of the rafters and screwed up a sheetrock, and he had to have all that fixed up bit of surgery. But really, that big heavy branch that jammed it into the ground was actually holding the tree up. If that branch wasn't there, it would have literally collapsed the entire garage and probably his sunroom as well. It would have just crushed it. That branch really was a blessing in disguise. It saved, you know, it took the brunt of the fall. Obviously, it pushed, like I say, it pushed about two or three feet into the ground. It's amazing. I saw it with my own eyes. I know it was there. It was unbelievable. But you know how much a tree weighs? It's quite heavy, especially when it's falling. So anyway, with that, I'm going to sign with you. Thanks for listening. And please, get on Facebook there. And if you got any questions or comments, anything you would like to see on the show, if you got a project coming up, you don't know about a product or something, you know, put a question out there. Either I will answer it, or I'm sure one of our other listeners will. It's a great place to exchange ideas and brag a little bit. So with that, I'm going to sign. I'll talk to you later. Have a good day. Thanks for listening to the Homeowner's Friend Podcast.
Don't try this at home. I'm a trained professional. I've got years and years of practice living this life I lead. Don't try this at home. I'm a trained professional. And I don't want no amateurs ending up like me. No amateurs ending up like me.
The Homeowner's Friend theme song, Trained Professionals by Billy Bourbon, is available on musicali.com. Check them out.